Before we start the episode, I have a few updates to share that I'm a little late on. Back in June of 2019, we told the story of Candy Mora, who was found brutally stabbed to death in her apartment in Harlingen, Texas on Monday, January 8, 1973. Candy's 2-year-old daughter was also inside the home. Luckily, she was unharmed. After a long reinvestigation that began in 2016, the Harlingen police and the Texas Rangers closed the case in October of 2020. They identified a man named Lewis Brewster as Candy's killer. He was a recent love interest and the individual who alerted police to her body. Unfortunately, Brewster was not brought before justice for murdering Candy. He died in November 2019 as a result of complications from diabetes. We also have an update in the Breonna Harps case. We told her story in early May of this year, 2021. Breonna was the innocent victim of gang violence, killed by a stray bullet in a drive-by shooting on Friday, May 17, 2019. On Memorial Day of this year, just weeks after our episode, Michael Kenneth Carter Jr., a 34-year-old alleged member of the Bloods, was gunned down inside Dallas nightclub Townhouse. Carter is, or was, also known by the nicknames Bingo and Bing Bing. He was a person of interest in the murder of Breonna Harps, and unfortunately, if he was responsible, he will never be brought before justice. Perhaps now someone with information will come forward, since fear of retribution from Carter is no longer in the equation. Mr. Harps, Breonna's father, has been tortured and in anguish since the loss of his daughter, and someone out there can without a doubt at least provide him with answers. If you have any information about the death of Breonna LaFay Harps, please call Trace Investigations at 817-200-4236. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
We assume a majority of folks listening to this are familiar with the February 1974 murder of Carla Walker, the first case we covered on Gone Cold. If you're not, you might want to stop this now, go back and listen to our very first episode titled Carla Walker Part 1, Carla's Story. Our update released on September 27th, 2020, titled The Abduction and Murder of Carla Walker, The Impact of the Arrest, and Honoring Carla's Memory. And our episode released on June 24th, 2021, titled The State of Texas versus the Accused Murderer of Carla Jan Walker, Pretrial Hearing 1. That should get you up to speed and prepared for what follows here, which covers a second pretrial hearing. That said, here's a really quick rundown of the first. On Wednesday, June 16, 2021, a pretrial hearing for 78-year-old Glenn Samuel McCurley was held in Tarrant County Criminal Court 1. McCurley is accused of abducting 17-year-old Carla Jan Walker from the passenger side seat of her boyfriend Rodney McCoy's car as they sat parked in the back lot of the Ridgely Brunswick Bowling Alley. McCurley allegedly pistol-whipped 18-year-old Rodney to the point that he lost consciousness and subsequently abducted, raped, and murdered Carla. The accused was 31 years old at the time. Perhaps the most significant ruling in the first pretrial hearing was to allow McCurley's confession into evidence, something his defense attorney Stephen Meyer was trying to get thrown out because McCurley never explicitly stated that he waived his rights to remain silent and have a lawyer present. However, considering the totality of the circumstances, the fact that the alleged killer never stopped running his mouth and never asked for representation, Judge Elizabeth Beach shot down the defense's motion to exclude the confession from the upcoming trial. If Judge Beach hadn't denied the motion, it likely would have had a positive effect on the defense's motion to exclude the warrant to search Glenn Samuel McCurley's home. That warrant was a direct result of the confession. When McCurley told detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett that he still had the .22 caliber Ruger he used to pistol whip Carla's boyfriend, the magazine of which had been left behind at the scene of Carla's abduction. McCurley told detectives where in his house to find it. The pistol was never stolen, like the accused told the cops back in 1974 when they were running down all such firearms in the area. Glenn Samuel McCurley had kept the gun for 46 years. The defense motion to exclude the search warrant, too, was denied at the proceedings. Also denied was the motion to exclude the accused's jailhouse confession, which he gave KRLD news radio reporter Andrew Greenstein shortly after his arrest while in custody at the Lon Evans Correction Center in downtown Fort Worth. These defense motions were denied not only because the defense seemed to be throwing shit at the wall to see what stuck, but also, no doubt, because Tarrant County Assistant Criminal District Attorneys Kim Davignon and Emily Dixon were prepared, and it was strikingly obvious that they knew exactly what to throw back. Carla's case is certainly in good hands. After a recess for lunch, the latter half of the first pretrial hearing consisted of testimony from pertinent DNA scientists, of which we didn't go into in the pretrial hearing 1 episode for a good reason. The motions put forth by the defense pertaining to the DNA evidence had yet to be ruled on by Judge Beach. After long testimonies and a series of bizarre questions put forth by McCurley's defense attorney to University of North Texas professor and ex-FBI senior scientist Dr. Bruce Badoli, the day ended with the defense asking for more time to prepare and alter their motions. The bizarre questions, by the way, were seemingly irrelevant and consisted of defense attorney Stephen Meyer demanding that Dr. Badoli tell the court when there will be a nationwide DNA database that every U.S. citizen is required by law to submit their DNA. It went on for a while and was truly and utterly mind-boggling. Our friend Kathleen suggested that perhaps Meyer was going after some fear-instilling, Big Brother is watching kind of thing. Dr. Badoli, in fact, appeared a little annoyed by the seemingly nonsensical line of inquiry. Anyway, court adjourned at a little after 3 p.m. It was a great day for the state versus Glenn Samuel McCurley, and another hearing was later scheduled for Friday, July 19, 2021. After discussing this second hearing, I'll go over a few things about Carla Walker's accused killer, along with a couple other things we knew about Carla's case long before McCurley was identified that now seem to fit the puzzle. One of which, a call to the Fort Worth police shortly after Carla was murdered, seems disgustingly similar to her alleged slayer's jailhouse confession. Simply put, Glenn Samuel McCurley's defense team filed several motions to exclude DNA evidence. That includes the work of Serological Research Institute and Othram Incorporated. Again, the defense asked for more time to prepare their argument at the first hearing, held on June 16, 2021, and on July 6, they submitted a brief to Judge Elizabeth Beach. While I certainly can't speak for all who attended the first pretrial hearing for the accused murderer of Carla Walker, I do know of one other individual who was chomping at the bit for the continuation. Kathleen Barnett is a close friend of Rodney McCoy and became a friend of ours way back in the summer of 2017 when we first started releasing episodes about Carla's case. We've kept in touch with her on a regular basis ever since. She's also an attorney, and since we've been going back and forth via text message about our thoughts on what was to come at the second hearing, I figured I'd be missing an opportunity if I didn't get her on the phone to chat beforehand. And we did the night before the hearing. Kathleen, as always, gave great insight. We discussed both the defendant's brief in support of their motions to suppress and the state's response brief.
Well, so have you been?
Tomorrow's the day.
Tomorrow is the day. I'd be lying if I said that this whole process, even with the defense's motions, even, you know, the first time around, it's been kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's like you don't want any little thing to go wrong.
Yeah. Have you thought about it anymore since we last talked?
I've mostly thought about what a good job I think the state's doing. I agree with the state's argument. But most importantly, I think even if they said you can't introduce any evidence about Osterup, I don't think it makes a difference. It's just a lead that was generated. Now, theory's important, but I think the state's explanation of the theory issues is totally understandable and seems to be the law.
Kathleen and I were both impressed by the state's response to the defense's motions. It was particularly well-written by Assistant Criminal District Attorney Kim Davignon. It's clear, concise, and without all the sleep-inducing legal ease the defense's brief was riddled with. Kathleen and I felt that the state had a far better grasp on the laws concerning the forensic evidence in Carla's case, or rather, how and by whom it was collected, and if it was done by legal means. All of the motions to exclude brought forth by the defense had one end goal, to get all the DNA evidence thrown out. It's like this. If the Serological Research Institute's work could be thrown out on a technicality, and Othram Incorporated's work on that same technicality, then there was nothing to lead Detectives Wagner and Bennett to McCurley and the DNA taken from his collected trash and eventually the swab he voluntarily allowed the detectives to take.
That's the biggest thing. He gave his DNA without a warrant. He voluntarily gave his DNA. I guess that'll be their next motion. It's a general rule you need a warrant to obtain DNA from a person because it's considered a search and it implicates the Fourth Amendment search and seizure stuff. But if a police officer seeks a voluntary consent to search, he doesn't even have to have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to do so, as long as he doesn't indicate that compliance is required. And the defense keeps trying to say, if the trash is out, everything's out. If Othram's out, everything's out. But he consented to a voluntary search. If they were going down the street asking everybody to give him a sample and he gave them one, you know, that's his problem.
Not to spoil anything, but the few in attendance at the July 9th, 2021 hearing were elated by Judge Beach's rulings. And no one was there on the defense side. Since the July 9th hearing was short, it lasted about 5 minutes, I'm going to go over each of the defense's motions via their brief and the state's response to each. Defense attorney Stephen Meyer, whose name I was mispronouncing on the pretrial one episode, sorry about that, seemed to dwell on the issue of trash collection a bit in the latest brief, but it was seemingly just a small jab that accompanied his larger point, that work done by Serological Research Institute, or SERI for short, should be inadmissible. Bear with me, the defense's briefs concerning the DNA evidence are unnecessarily convoluted and slightly redundant. I'll do the best I can. The defense's brief opens with a summary of the steps taken to obtain evidence and identify the suspect in the Carla Walker murder case. On November 19, 2019, evidence was sent to SERI in California, including Carla's bra. A stain was identified on the bra, to be specific, on the right strap near the cup and testing of that stain resulted in a single-source male profile that was suitable for comparing to a suspect's DNA, if a suspect were to be identified. Seary's report to Fort Worth detectives of their findings was dated March 11, 2020. Since the profile created produced no matches in the FBI's Combined DNA Index System, or CODIS, which the defense team doesn't mention in this brief, that extract created at Seary was sent to Othram Incorporated in The Woodlands, Texas. The technology Othram uses identifies substantially more DNA markers than Seary's work, which can be used proficiently in genetic genealogical research. That's what happened, and through GEDmatch, a site specifically developed for users to conduct such research, the name McCurley was identified. The defense here was sure to point out that this was done without a warrant or court order. Because a man named Glenn Samuel McCurley was a suspect way back in 1974, the brief explains, on July 7, 2020, Fort Worth police officers took trash that had been placed out on McCurley's curb for city collection. The items were sent to Seary in California and tested, and on September 4, 2020, the cops found out that Glenn McCurley's DNA was found on a McDonald's straw within the trash collected. Now, the defense's brief here leaves out the next step Detectives Wagner and Bennett took, which was asking for and obtaining a DNA sample straight from the source by swabbing McCurley's cheek. Perhaps the omission was purposeful, perhaps not. For whatever reason, the brief goes straight to the detectives obtaining a warrant for the alleged killer's arrest. It continues with the actual arrest, then goes to McCurley's confession, leading detectives to the whereabouts of the gun he used in the attack, most notably by bludgeoning Carla's boyfriend, Rodney McCoy, in the head repeatedly. Allegedly, I guess. The brief goes on to say that the detectives obtained a search warrant based on this information and were able to find the .22 Ruger firearm. The summary ended by noting that 4 out of 5 Othram Incorporated lab workers who had their hands on the Carla Walker case were unlicensed by the Texas Commission on Forensic Sciences, as was one of the 2 from the Serological Research Institute. The next section of the brief gets down to the nitty-gritty, the motion to suppress. It reads in its entirety, quote, "Defendant moves the court to suppress and exclude from evidence all testimony related to the data generated by Othram and Seary. Any evidence obtained due to violating Criminal Code Procedure Articles 3801 and 3835 must also be suppressed under CCP Article 38.23," end quote. Section 3 of the brief cites what the defense calls the applicable laws for their motions to suppress, starting by pointing out that in Article 3801, Section 3A of the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, the Texas Forensic Science Commission is a rulemaking authority. That means the court is bound to follow the rules they set in place. Texas Code of Criminal Procedure Article 3835 states, quote, "A forensic analysis of physical evidence under this article and expert testimony relating to the evidence are not admissible in a criminal action if, at the time of the analysis, the crime laboratory conducting the analysis was not accredited by the commission under Article 3801," end quote. Since Title 37, Rule 651.5 of the Texas Administrative Code plainly states that many forensic biology methods, including DNA SNPs, have accreditations available, the defense argued, the work Othram Incorporated performed is inadmissible because all those who performed the preparation, quantification, and sequencing of the DNA extract were not Texas Forensic Science Commission accredited. But there's a problem with McCurley's defense argument, as the state points out in their response brief. At the heart of that problem is the defense's failure to understand exactly what Othram Incorporated does, even after Othram's Dr. John Fonden explained it at the first pretrial hearing. The state argued that forensic genetic genealogy is a new technology in the world of criminal justice, relatively speaking. What Othram does, the state argues, is analyze tens of thousands of markers and loci across a given genome, far more than the standard DNA STR technology used in criminal investigations. So ultimately, this is used to more accurately determine the amount of the genome folks share than the standard. A genetic marker is a DNA sequence with a known location on a genome. Loci refers to a specific physical location of a gene or sequence on a chromosome. These can be used to measure relationships between two people. This whole genome shotgun sequencing, as it is referred to in the state's brief, includes the data, the markers, and loci being loaded into a kit and put through the GEDmatch database. Potential links, as match here is the wrong word, of genetic relationships are then sent back. This is how the surname McCurley was identified in the Carla Walker case. But I don't want to get too far off point, and we've discussed what happened from there above. First of all, the defense relies on the assumption, and assuming it seems is all they did, that because Othram uses DNA SNPs, which are covered under the Criminal Code's requirement for accreditation, that accreditation for what the company does is available. Now, SNPs stands for single nucleotide polymorphisms and are the most common type of genetic variation among folks. Each SNP represents a difference in a single DNA building block, and these variations are found most commonly in the DNA between genes. But DNA SNPs are only a fraction of Othram's process. In the state's response brief, ADA Kim Davignon brilliantly, clearly, and succinctly analogized the defense's lack of understanding of the forensic genetic genealogy process Othram uses. For DNA dummies like me, Davignon couldn't have laid it out better. Quote, "In the simplest terms, you need third grade math to do algebra, but that doesn't make algebra the same as third grade math. It is, to quote Dr. Fonden, the scale of what forensic genetic genealogy entails that separates it from being simply DNA SNPs. DNA SNPs is not a technology. A SNP is a natural phenomenon's variation that exists within populations, and there are a variety of technologies to genotype SNPs at different scales. So, DNA SNPs is a portion of the bigger science that is forensic genetic genealogy, much like third-grade math is to algebra." End quote. Here's the deal. As Othram's Dr. Fondom, an ex-FBI senior scientist and director of the University of North Texas Center for Human Identification, Dr. Bruce Badoli, said at the first hearing, there is no accreditation currently available from the Texas Forensic Science Commission for forensic genetic genealogy. That directly ties to the exemption in the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, specifically Article 3801, Section 4D, Line C, which states, quote, "The Commission by rule may exempt from the accreditation process a crime laboratory conducting a forensic analysis or a type of analysis, examination, or test if the Commission determines that independent accreditation is unavailable or inappropriate for the laboratory or the type of analysis, examination, or test performed by the laboratory." End quote. The state ends this argument by noting that forensic genetic genealogy is an investigative tool, and it's an investigative tool used by agencies all over the state, including the Texas Rangers. It was used in Carla's case, and in most cases, only to point to a suspect. When Glenn Samuel McCurley voluntarily gave his DNA to detectives, the DNA STR was used to link the alleged murderer to the crime. That is the DNA evidence here. Judge Beach agreed with the expert testimony and the state and denied the defense's motion to suppress. Glenn Samuel McCurley's defense team had more or less the same argument in their attempt to have excluded from trial the forensic work done by Serological Research Institute, or SERI. SERI, if you'll remember, identified the stain on Carla's bra and created a DNA extract from it. I'm going to spare y'all the defense's argument this time around, for the most part, and only say that they believed a SERI employee, unaccredited by the Texas Forensic Science Commission, performed DNA work that required such accreditation. The state's response is far more interesting here, as they laid out the work performed at SERI using actual testimony from the individual who was responsible for it, Mallory Pagenkopf. At the first pretrial hearing, Pagenkopf testified via Zoom that when the evidence in the Carla Walker case arrived, she began photographing it. Each item was documented concerning its condition and assigned identification numbers. Next, Pagenkopf determined by using an alternative specific light source which items should be tested. This led to her identifying what appeared to be a bodily fluid stain on Carla's bra, and she cut a sample of the stain, after which Pagenkopf placed it into a tube. Using an advanced extraction machine, Pagenkopf extracted DNA. Next, the extract was placed in a well plate that contained 96 wells, after which an employee named Aaron Lori checked that the wells were filled and marked correctly. Lori placed the well plate in a real-time PCR machine, which was used to detect specific genetic material and estimate how much is present. Lori started the machine. Mallory Pagenkopf then analyzed this quantification and proceeded with amplification, or create identical copies of the DNA target in order to properly analyze the material. Later, it was determined through a similar process that the same DNA profile was also present on Carla Walker's dress. The DNA data was sent to be entered into FBI's CODIS, where it received no hits, and then the extract to Othram, where the forensic genetic genealogy process was completed, identifying the surname McCurley. Upon the realization that Glenn Samuel McCurley was a suspect in the initial investigation, Fort Worth detectives Wagner and Bennett began a more traditional police investigation. They interviewed the man, McCurley's trash was taken, sent to SERI, where Mallory Pagenkopf performed confirmatory testing and matched a DNA profile from a discarded McDonald's straw to the suspect's DNA found on Carla's bra. After that was matched, detectives asked Glenn McCurley for a buccal swab. He complied, and Pagenkopf determined that it too was the same profile. Mallory Pagenkopf is certified in the state of Texas by the Texas Forensic Science Commission. Aaron Lori of SERI is not. Now, the defense argued in their brief that because Lori started the real-time PCR machine, that the work done at SERI should be thrown out. But the state argued that Lori did no analysis, and they were obviously correct. ADA Kim Davignon again provided a great analogy in her brief. Quote, "To sum it up in layman's terms, Miss Lori's role is akin to being the person who starts a dishwasher at home when it gets full. Someone else, Miss Pagenkopf, loaded the dishwasher with her dishes. Miss Lori ensured the dishes were in the machine and started it. Then Miss Pagenkopf unloaded her portion of the machine and made sure the dishes were clean, i.e. that the machine did its job. It's simplistic but analogous to what Miss Lori did in regard to the well plate in this case. Her role in the quantification process did not involve actual analysis, and as such, cannot be a reason to have the DNA STR, which was analyzed by a certified Texas forensic analyst, suppressed under the standards created by Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, Section 3835. End quote. That's amazing. I love it. When we got settled into the courtroom for the second pretrial hearing, we already knew it would be a much shorter day than the first, which lasted around 7 hours, including recesses. I, for one, had no idea it would take only about 5 minutes. Both the defense and the state told Judge Elizabeth Beach that everything was argued in their briefs and that they would put forward no further arguments. Judge Beach denied all the defense's motions to exclude evidence and testimony by Othram and Seary. Like the first, this continuation was a win, a good day for the state of Texas versus Glenn Samuel McCurley, accused of the capital murder of 17-year-old Carla Jan Walker in February of 1974. The night before these judgments, as Kathleen Barnett and I spoke about the upcoming morning and our optimism for that morning, while perhaps hiding from one another our worry and fear that something might go wrong, we spoke in depth about the case. We talked about Tommy Ray Neeland, a serial killer who was caught in 1974 after a botched abduction, shortly after Carla's slaying. Neeland's crimes were much different, but he was a suspect for a while, though he never confessed, as some recent coverage of Carla's case would have you believe. In fact, Neeland always adamantly denied involvement. Jimmy Dean Sasser, however, did confess in 1977, but the guy had a drug problem and a confession problem. Kathleen and I spoke some about him as well, and Detective John Terrell's obsession with his suspect in Carla's case, William Ted Wilhoit. But Glenn Samuel McCurley was who we primarily discussed, of course. During the first pretrial, McCurley most often appeared as though he'd fallen asleep or was completely disinterested. But he was caught by observers rubbernecking to see photographs of evidence when the state displayed them during Mallory Pagankoff's testimony, Carla's stained and tattered dress and bra. Perhaps he felt the same sick nostalgia for those items as he did with the .22 caliber Ruger he kept all these years. Speaking of which, in the fourth part of Gone Cold's episodes about Carla Walker, originally released in August 2017, there were only two sentences about the cops' attempts to locate every person who had purchased a .22 caliber Ruger handgun in Fort Worth and the surrounding areas in a specific unknown time frame. While we always wanted to know who the one person out of the 25 to 30 who could not account for his Ruger was, because this person said it had been stolen in a burglary, we never got a name. There was no way to without the police file. It was never a name in the investigation that was made public, unlike the sensational detective magazine-style stories of Neeland, Sasser, and Wilhoit. The missing Ruger detail was always bothersome, but often fell to the wayside while going down other rabbit holes. It's difficult not to obsess over other details, other facts of the case that may or may not be tied to McCurley. For instance, starting sometime after Carla was buried, and continuing for many years after, the family would visit her final resting place, only to find a single carnation placed in the urn at her grave. They never knew who it was. That, and the phone calls the Walkers received for some time after Carla's murder, was all that McCurley? There was also, apparently, a tip-off to police about the location of Carla's body, according to ex-Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Jim Minter. Minter also told us something else years ago, something Kathleen and I discussed when we spoke. The Fort Worth Police Department received a call shortly after Carla's body was found that sounds a lot like the bullshit Glenn Samuel McCurley told KRLD News reporter Andrew Greenstein. McCurley told Greenstein, quote, "She just gave me a hug. I gave her a kiss. I mistook her for something else. I didn't mean to do it." End quote. In the 1974 call, the caller's speech was described as slurred, as if he'd been drinking, like McCurley was, he says, the night he abducted Carla and bludgeoned Rodney McCoy in the head with his Ruger. "I didn't mean to kill her," the man on the line lamented. "I just wanted to fuck her." However, instead of transferring the call, the officer who answered simply asked for the man's name and phone number so that a detective could call him back. He hung up, and no information about the caller, to our knowledge, was ever obtained. It's possible that in mid-August 2021, when the trial for the accused murderer of Carla Jan Walker gets underway, perhaps we'll get answers to those questions. I'll be there, and I'll let you know if we do. Again, it feels like justice is inching closer and closer. Thanks for listening, y'all.